Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and since I'm on location again, this time in the Central Pacific, Vicky won't be joining me. Actually, I'm in the shark-enhanced, not-infested waters of Palau. 9 years ago, when I was last here, we presented the president with a Peter Benchley Ocean Award for Palau's work in protecting the island nation's waters, 80% of which are now designated as marine protected areas. So, first, some blue news you can use. We're back with our friend and ocean champion, Representative Jared Huffman of California, in his D.C. office. Among his other positions, he's ranking member, which is to say the lead Democrat, on the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries. So, two quick questions. With the Trump administration gutting NOAA, firing the Commandant of the Coast Guard, promoting offshore oil drilling and deep sea mining, even putting mercury back in the tuna by letting pollution controls wash away, what are you able to do to protect our public seas, given the MAGA majority in the House and Senate, and what can you do and what can our listeners do?
Yeah. Well, thank you for checking in with me during what is a pretty dark time for these things we care about, the planet, but certainly oceans and all of the biodiversity challenges. Look, we're going the wrong direction here under the Trump administration. They are trying to roll back decades of policy progress. They are gutting agencies across the board that we depend on for science and for marine ecosystem sustainability and commercial fishing and so many other things. And they're also at an even higher level trying to tear down our democracy, which will make it really hard to push good policy in the future. You know, totalitarian regimes generally aren't all that sustainable.
Yeah, democracy seems like a prerequisite for getting any environmental protections going.
I think so. So look, we're fighting on all fronts, and you know, we've got to prevent this administration, which hopefully will just be a 4-year anomaly in the arc of progress, but prevent them from doing things that are irreparable, doing things that'll make it, you know, even harder for us to be a leader on the global stage. I mean, you know that we're sometimes an outlier in things like Law of the Sea Treaty and any number of other multilateral instruments where we should be leading. And yeah, what he's doing with deep sea mining is just making us even more of a lone ranger, if not a pariah.
Yeah, it's like we'd be the new pirates. I mean, the U.S. hasn't signed on, but we've always been in compliance with the law of the seas.
Right.
And we've actually gotten to good place in fisheries, and he's getting rid of those.
Yeah, so we will have to relearn painful lessons, right? This notion that there are some people that, you know, don't seem to understand how we got to Magnuson-Stevens, and you know, they just think sustainable fishery management, you know, can be taken for granted. I hope we don't have to, you know, relearn the lessons of the cod and other fisheries that we've totally crashed with overfishing, but it seems like we're heading that way.
Right. So you're doing what you can here on the Hill in Congress. What do citizens do to not feel frustrated, to feel that they're doing something?
You know, there's a number of things. You can support the groups that are lawyered up and fighting these things in court. That is probably a more effective point of resistance than the U.S. Congress right now, because this Republican Congress is uninterested in questioning or pushing back on any of it. So, yeah, groups that litigate I appreciate them a lot right now. But the other thing is, as consumers, I still think that we have a huge role to play. In America, consumers don't want to have illicitly caught fish in their seafood supply chain. They don't want to have slave labor on their dinner menu. So that, I think, continues to be a really important just sort of aspect of this.
So make consumer choices, take them to court, take it to the streets.
Take it to the streets.
And since I'm here diving, thought it would be great to talk with someone who organizes dive charters, part of the multi-billion dollar global scuba diving industry. And that someone is Tiana Yi Thun, co-owner of Dive & More, a company that focuses its dive trips on photography, underwater photography, and more recently, marine conservation. Tiani was born in Melbourne, Australia, but now lives in Byron Bay, a surfing hotspot. Along with being a businesswoman, underwater photographer, surfer, and drone pilot, she's also a marine biologist. So, Tiani, a lot to cover. We'd normally start with your first connections with the ocean, but this time let's start with your most recent dive, which was, what, about 2 hours ago?
Thanks so much, David. Really happy to be here, and thanks for having me. Yeah, our last dive a couple of hours ago, wow, that was incredible. We were down there, we were watching some fish swim around, like watching fish TV, and then suddenly two mantas came swimming by, and we even saw one swim up and jump out of the surface and do a belly flop. I've never seen that before. I have seen hundreds of manta rays, but never seen one jump out of the water. That was absolutely insane, and everybody was such high spirits underwater. We were all going crazy, and as soon as we got up, you could hear the excitement, everybody chit-chatting, screaming and whooping and yelling, and I just had such a great time. What an incredible dive. And here in Palau, all the dives, it seems like every single dive has just been amazing, 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 insane.
And full disclosure, I was on that dive and it's like you're looking at a 10-foot manta, its wingspan flying like some great predator beast, and you look down and there's like a shark and a trevally passing by, you know. Go down to the bottom, there's a moray eel. Go up and it's a fish tornado, right?
Right, and there was a leopard shark and one of the turtles as well. Those cleaner shrimp as well. It was honestly like we're in a nature documentary underwater, just living it, living the real world.
And we've seen, a spawning event with big red snapper. We've seen a shark feeding frenzy, which you don't find that often. And this is, you know, Palau's 15 years into fully protecting its waters. It's a small nation that values the ocean. So back to our origin story, how did you first connect to the ocean?
Okay, well, I guess this one goes way back. I guess when I was young, I grew up not exactly right by the ocean, but it was about 30 minutes to an hour away to our closest beach. And my parents used to always take us on holidays. We would go to the beach, we'd go with our friends, and we'd always go boogie boarding. And I loved boogie boarding. I got very competitive into my boogie boarding. We would do it on every family trip, so that's something I really look forward to. But I was always really curious as well about what was under the water. I especially loved growing up watching H2O Just Add Water, the mermaid show, and really connected with that. Always loved, you know, seeing what was under there, and found such wonder and beauty and mystery in it. And I think it was only when I started free diving, when it was after my bachelor's that I studied overseas.
Okay, and was that marine biology?
Oh, it wasn't actually. At first I studied psychology. I was super interested in, I sort of was interested in psychology and marine biology. I couldn't choose. So I ended up doing a psychology, and I did some marine science classes on the side. So I did marine biology, oceanography. I found those classes to be super cool, super interesting.
And where was that?
That was in upstate New York, actually. I was there on a tennis scholarship. Actually, I don't know if I told you yet. Yeah, so it was a good opportunity to go and travel and also study for free and, you know, pursue a little bit of my tennis career.
So this was Syracuse or what, upstate New York?
Yeah, I went to a small college in Syracuse first. I spent 2 years there. Then I spent 2 years in Binghamton University afterwards. Yeah, that was fun.
And then you came home to...
Yeah, so it was actually on my way home. I stopped over in Hawaii and I did a volunteer there for like on a farm, a woofing. So I was there for 6 weeks, and that was when I first learned free diving. And I remember I was in Hawaii free diving and there was like four turtles swimming around me. And this was like such an epic experience. I loved the feeling so much.
But you were working on a farm there?
Yeah, I was volunteering.
Okay, volunteering at what kind of farm?
It was a ranch, so they had horses, animals.
Very nice. And then you were free diving. And
in our spare time. So we'd work on the farm in the mornings, and then the afternoon we would go freediving, we'd go surfing, we'd have the afternoons off to explore the island. And it was really, really beautiful. So after that, I guess I had such an amazing time there, and I was so curious to learn more about the ocean because it always fascinated me. And then I just sort of out of the blue applied for my master's at James Cook University back home in Australia. And I got in, so I was like, I'm leaving Hawaii early. I was going to stay for a bit longer. And I was like, I'm going to do it. And
James Cook, a very famous marine science school in Townsville, Queensland, Australia.
Exactly. So I kind of like took that leap, and I was like, you know what? It's completely different to my other degree, but it's all right. I'm just going to change it because I'm super interested and I'm going to follow my passion and what I love. So I sort of went on to do that. And then, you know, after studying, you know, we had to learn scuba diving. I remember in one of my classes, we did a class over in Thailand. And one of the, like, to collect the data as we were going over the reef, it was so much easier to be scuba diving because you could stay down there. And when you were snorkeling, you'd have to go up and down and up and down. So I was jealous of all scuba divers.
So the uni, what you call university, required that you learn scuba to do marine biology.
It didn't exactly require it, but for the research that I wanted to do, it was better to have it. Because if you wanted to study the corals, which I was really interested in, it was definitely easier to have your scuba diving certificate. So I got certified and I just fell in love. And I was, from then on, I was like, this is where I'm meant to be. This is what I'm meant to be doing.
Okay, so you got a master's in what?
So I got a master's in marine biology.
What was your master thesis?
My master's thesis was visualizing soft coral habitats on Pelorus Island. So I made these underwater 3D maps of the soft coral habitats there on, it was a small island on the Great Barrier Reef. So that was really fun. And I did also write a thesis on photography and the impact photography has on the conservation message in Australia. And I found that really the most interesting was like the impact, the difference between humans and nature and how humans relate to nature and our interactions with it. So I found that really, that topic super interesting.
So back to your psychology.
Back to the psychology. Actually, yes, mixing them both together. It's all related.
And is this when you started with underwater photography?
Yes, at the same time it was COVID and we, you know, all our classes turned online. So I thought, why not move to Magnetic Island, which was the island that was just 20 minutes by ferry off of Townsville where our university was. It's a beautiful place. And luckily, I was so lucky that I was living with actually an Australian photographer. He was my housemate. So he taught me basically all of the basics and he inspired me to buy my first underwater camera. And then from then on, you know, the rest was history.
Oh, tell us, what was your first underwater camera?
It was the Olympus TG6, that little red one. And it was so funny. I thought like he was taking all these amazing photos. He had the same camera as me. And I look at my photos and be like, why don't mine look like that? And then he was like, oh, well, why don't you try getting a bit closer? Why don't you try shooting from below? And after, you know, a lot of practice, spending a lot of hours in the water, I finally started getting some good shots, but it was a thing that we were doing every single day. A lot of hours were put in and many hundreds of photos deleted as well.
Okay, so it's COVID, you're on Magnetic Island, which is about probably the nicest place in the world to be during COVID. Learning photography, you've got your degree. Are you thinking academics? Are you thinking, I mean, I'm curious how you got into the dive industry.
Oh, well, yes, I guess after I graduated, I started work at the university. I was doing sort of I was writing for the State of the Tropics report, and that was really cool work. But I felt like I had just been traveling, I had been sailing, I had been diving after I graduated. And then I went into this sort of office-based role and I was doing that for a few weeks. And then I thought, you know what? This is not it. I need to be out there. I need to be in the water every single day because that's where I love and that's where I want to, like, I feel most at home and that's where I want to be. So I left that position and I thought, you know what, I'm going to save up some money and I'm going to get my dive instructors. And so the next year I was still working at the university, but I was in a different role and I was in more of the education field. And I loved that. I love that so much. I loved having my students and I do the marine biology talks to them and they were all so keen to learn and I'd help them with their subjects and stuff as well. So then after that, after a year, I'd saved up enough to do my dive instructor course. And then that's when I headed over to Malaysia to do it, just the end of 2023. And since then, you know, it's been amazing. It's been so fun.
So you were a dive instructor in Malaysia.
That's where I did my course. I came back to Australia and I started working in the Gold Coast doing some instructing. And then for the rest of last year, I actually was working on a sailboat and I was instructing and also doing photography and videography as well. It was a sailing YouTube channel. So I was teaching the new crew some their new courses and then I was also photographing and documenting the marine life there on all of our travels there. So that was really cool.
And tell us about Dive and More, how you got involved with this company, what it does. And
Dive and More. right. So amazingly, I found Dive and More online when I was like looking for new jobs. I was on the job hunt and I sent Danielle, my co-owner now, my business partner now, I sent her an email and I said, Danielle, you need to hire me because I love the projects that you've created. I love the trips that you're running and I want to lead one of them. And I saw they were both marine conservation and underwater photography. And those are two things that I am super passionate about. And so she came back to me and she said, oh my gosh, like Tiani, I think I've just manifested you because I just thought I need someone in my company and I need someone, actually, I don't need to hire someone, but I need a business partner and I need someone who's a marine biologist and an underwater photographer. And you've just sent me this email and it seems like it's a sign. So I said, oh, okay, like let's jump on a call. So we jumped on a video call and we got along so well and it was super easy.
And the focus, a lot of dive charters have different focus. A lot of them are kind of techie. Some are like, you know, Texas singles. I mean, it's all over the map, but with the focus of your dives is underwater photography, correct?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Okay, so what are like the five basic mistakes people make when they decide to start taking pictures underwater?
Well, the five.
Or two, or what's the big ones that you like encounter with your students, clients?
Well, funnily, I think that people have such high expectations for themselves because on land photography it's a lot easier on land, right? You don't have currents, you don't have poor visibility too often, you don't have animals, but they're underwater, everything's moving so fast, you're moving, you've got to control your buoyancy. So I think a lot of common problems that some beginner divers will be like, oh, my photos don't look amazing to start with, but I'm always telling people, well, you know, you've got to practice. It's completely different to land photography. It's a whole new world. First, you have to be comfortable as a diver first and, you know, be really aware underwater. And that's a skill already in itself. And then you've got to know your camera and, you know, usually underwater, you've got a big housing. So all the buttons are in different places. And then you've got to, you know, shoot different angles and you've got to position yourself. And most importantly, you've got to know the marine animals and their behavior as well and how they react to your photos. And if some of them are dangerous or some of them don't like the flash or some of them, you know, some of them have symbiotic relationships with other animals.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
We believe that when people get involved with conservation and can get hands-on and learn about it too, then they're going to feel like that they can, you know, really make a difference and most importantly, learn and understand what's happening out there in our marine world and just become more aware of all of the amazing projects that are going on. And I think it's sort of that when people get involved and they see things for themselves and they can see it happening and they participate and they do it too, then they get more passionate about those things too. And that's when they're going to want to protect it and advocate for that more. But, you know, all of our clients that come on our trips, including yourself, David, are just fantastic. And everybody's already so passionate about the ocean. So I think it's just about keeping things interesting and keeping our trips, you know, exciting and different and making people excited to join in on them and just having that really nice group feeling.
You'd think the dive industry, like the surf industry, has created Surf Rider, 50,000 members around the world, small number of surfers, but you know, surfers experience it pretty quickly that that, you know, if the beach is shut down, there's no surf that day. The diving industry has been much slower to respond to like the endangerment of coral reefs around the world.
I think when studying marine biology, being around a lot of marine biologists, I'm almost in my little bubble of friends and colleagues who are all really passionate and care so much about what's going on and keeping up to date with politics and all of this. But I think that sometimes there's just a lack of knowledge with a lot of people come recreationally diving too, and maybe it's not part of the everyday lifestyle. So every day, maybe if they live in a bigger city, maybe they're a bit more removed from the ocean, or they don't get to see these changes every day as surfers do every single day. You know, they're out there.
That conforms to my belief. Surfers are like in it, and when it gets polluted, they feel it, they get sick, ear infections. Most recreational diving is away diving. Mm-hmm. And so if you come to Palau, it's beautiful. If you go to Hawaii, you may not see the loss of coral till you come back 10 years later.
Exactly. Unless you're a local diver who, you know, happens to live in a beautiful spot where you can dive, but a majority of the population, they don't, right? Especially over in the US, a lot of people are landlocked. I could never live somewhere I couldn't dive. Hey, I need to be able to do both diving and surfing.
What are your hopes and worries in terms of both the business and the ocean?
What I hope for is that we could reach more and more people and just more people will start diving. So a really big passion of mine is, you know, sharing my photos and videos and sharing this message of the ocean and sharing images that people don't get to see every day. If people can see for themselves, and sometimes even if they just see it, you know, a video or a photo of it, and be like, whoa, and just become a bit more curious about the ocean and want to take a dive course or want to start snorkeling or just get out there a little bit and experience it for themselves and learn a little bit more about it. I'm a really big believer that people will care about and protect what they know. And a lot of people just don't know how incredible our ocean is under there. And there's a lot of fear behind it too, which is crazy for us to think about, but it's true because it's the fear of the unknown.
Well, yesterday we saw hundreds of sharks. And we did. Then my nephew was attacked by a Titan triggerfish defending its nest. And last time I was here, I got bit by one. So instead of yelling shark, shark, yell trigger, yell. Trigger.
Exactly. It is funny that a lot of people are so afraid of sharks, but then, you know, it's actually the stinging fire corals that we've got to be more careful of, or it's the jellyfish, or it's, yes, exactly, those trigger fish when they're nesting.
Stepping on urchins. Done that.
Exactly.
Ouch.
So much more out there that's much more common to get injuries from.
And in Australia, you've got so many things that will kill you on and off the reef. How's Australia doing in terms of marine conservation?
Well, Australia, our current climate situation, yes, we're not doing, we're not, you know, pioneers in marine conservation, but we should be. So we have the Great Barrier Reef, we have the Great Southern Reef, all the kelp forests that I know you love.
Help
the kelp. But still, we are a little bit behind on, you know, changing policies towards renewables. And I think we could do better. I do believe that we could be one of the world leaders in marine conservation, and we should be. But there is, you know, this balance, and it is people's, you know, jobs and people's livelihoods as well. So it's a very social issue as well. And it's just sort of we're making slow progress, but there are a lot of good people out there doing the good work. And I'm lucky to know a few of them. So I feel like we're going the right direction. So we can only hope, right? We can't be pessimistic about it, because that's not going to get us anywhere. We've got to be, you know, optimistic, and we've got to lead the way forwards. That's our job, isn't it?
And where do you see yourself in 5 and 10 years?
Well, hopefully diving somewhere on a tropical island and leading a trip and giving some photography and marine conservation talks. So maybe doing what I'm doing right now in 5 years. I would like to do this for a few more years. I would love to work more as well on marine documentary films and start creating some of my own films as well. So that's sort of an idea for the future. And I think I would just keep doing what I love. I want to keep traveling to new places, diving with new animals. I want to see the Arctic and the Antarctic, but maybe just once, because I don't love the cold. I want to see all the things.
They're wonderful places. And yes, like the kelp forest, a lot colder than here, but still spectacular.
Exactly. And I want to see all of the nudibranchs there are to find as well, and all the small things, all the big things, and also the small things, the pygmy seahorses.
Life everlasting in our everlasting sea.
exactly.
So, Tiani Dunn, thank you so much for being part of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast.
Thanks for having me, David. Very happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.